think the younger children are leaving, so we'll take a minute and let them get settled. By reading, I'd like to, Daniel 11 being a fairly long chapter, I'd like to read verses 1 through 5 and then 30 through 45. 1 through 5 and 30 through 45. That'll, well, as you'll note, that will comprise I was going to say the part that is probably most germane to what we'll be talking about, except for between 5 and 29, we will look at it in some detail probably. Okay, 11. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I stood to confirm and to strengthen him. And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far greater than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. And the king of the south, and you notice there's a change in thought here, the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And we'll drop down to verse 30. For the ships of Kittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved, and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant. And arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall prepare the they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity, and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help. But many shall cleave to them with flatteries. And some of them of understanding shall fall, to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for an appointed time. And the king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. For that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his realm shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver, and with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. Again, a significant change in discussion at this moment from the Gabriel. And at that time shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. And he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace upon the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Okay, I want to make just a couple of statements which you probably already know, but I'll do it just for the... So I've done it. In what will follow, I've used Brother Thomas's dates from either Chronicon Hebricon or the Exposition of Daniel. Also, I would now like to read from the Exposition of Daniel, and this deals a little bit with the outline, which will be helpful to us, I think. On page 48, and you'll note the verses he's talking about, what he calls the first section, and he's talking now about the first section of the scripture that we've just read. In the outline, you'll note that there are more sections. Section 1 is in the outline as point 2. Point 2, Roman numeral 2, one point. The second division that he speaks of will be in point 6 in the outline. This might be helpful to you just thinking about verses. And the third section of Daniel 11, which is 40 through 45, is point 7, Roman numeral 7 in the outline. I should have said that the second section comprises just verses 36 through 39. So that's generally the... And this is what Brother Tom... And where that came from is right from Exposition of Daniel, page 48 in the edition that I have, which is the same one that two or three of you used, because I've been able to look behind what the brother said to read with him. Maybe you can too also. Now, Brother Thomas says, and I'm not absolutely certain he ever calls this the first section, but if you drop down a little bit, he starts talking about the second section, and he also talks about the third section. So therefore, this must be the first. He says, from the third verse of the 11th chapter, the discourse treats of the goat's notable horn. In respect of the succession of his dominion, and from the 5th to the 29th verse of the mutual rivalries, wars, and policy of the northern and southern horns of the goat, and from the 30th to the 33rd inclusive of the indignation of the northern horn against Judah, Jerusalem, and the evening morning sacrifice, and the 34th and 35th verses of the help the Jews experienced under the Asmoneans till they were subjected to the little horn of the goat, a nation of a fierce countenance whose tongue they did not understand. So that's the first section, and I think we realize what we're looking at is a long, in the outline it would be presented to us from 312 in the north to 168 and 312 to 168 in the north, and from 323 to 169 B.C. in the south. And we're going to read something on that when we get to that point. But that just, I think we need to fix our chronologies in our minds early. Now, the second section, which we're going to speak to a little bit, it's verses 36 through 39, and you really have to make a strong line of demarcation, I think, between the 35th verse, which is talking about the northern and southern horns. When you move to the 36th verse, it's talking about the Latino-Greek Babylonian power. So, Brother Thomas writes, the second section is descriptive of the Latino-Greek Babylonian power, which established its dominion over the territories of the northern and southern horns of the goat and over the Holy Land, and which was to prosper or maintain its position to the exclusion of Judah till the indignation against them should be accomplished, or for a short space after the termination of the 2400 years. So keep that in mind. Brother Thomas is telling us that that will be for a short space after the 2400 years is concluded. Now, he believed that the 2400 years concluded in 1860. I'll leave that to your thought, what you want to think about the 2400 years in 1860. I happen to think he's right. So I think the translation is right at 2400 because it comes from the Septuagint. And I did take a moment and look in the, got so many books I probably can't find it. Oh yeah, this is a book entitled The Timetables of Jewish History. And interestingly enough, here's what they say. I'm off the text, so we'll go back to that in a moment. Following an ancient tradition of translating laws, Jews of Alexandria, Egypt, rendered the Torah, five books of Moses, in Greek, according to legend, preserved in the letter of Aristeus from the next century. King Ptolemy II, so you can look on your chart and see when King Ptolemy II reigned, commissioned the translation from 72 Jewish scholars from Jerusalem who completed the task in 72 days. The translation known, therefore, as the Septuagint, which means 70, reflects a text of the Torah slightly different from the traditional Jewish Masoretic text, but occasionally anticipates interpretations codified in later rabbinic law. The translation is careful not to use terms associated with paganism in describing worship of God. Reflecting Hellenistic aesthetics, the Septuagint translates not what God saw, not that God saw creation was good, but it was beautiful. Greek-speaking Jews for centuries and will be adopted by the early Christian church. And I think that's very accurate. Now, we could follow that on through. We can see the letter. About 100 years later, that letter of Arius was published. So that means to me, kind of, that he wrote the letter about 100 years after the Septuagint, and was just talking, had been translated. And he was talking to them about the use of it. But, you know, if we think logically, by 260, there were a lot of Jews, perhaps Orthodox Jews included, were living throughout the Greek world. And the one thing the Greek Jews would want would be a translation in a text that they could read. You know, they're very quick in America to follow English translations. Because, look, you get, even in an Orthodox congregation, probably 70% can't read Hebrew. And they don't, they're not satisfied not to read words that they understand. Now, they pick and choose. Like they will use Hupper, as Brother Scott used last night, for the canopy at their wedding, and they'll pick out certain things, Shabbat, Sukkoth, those words, and use them. But generally speaking, that text will be in English. So, back in 260, I have no issue that the Septuagint was translated by the scholars, because Ptolemy II was relatively friendly with the Jewish people. So he would have considered it feather in his cap to have pacified them or made them like him more by providing them with their scriptures, the five books of Moses and the prophets written in the Greek language. Okay, does that make sense? Okay, so anyway, that's why I think, and that helps me at least appreciate Brother Thomas, who, whether he picked it up from the Septuagint, I think his brother Darrell maybe mentioned the other day, there were other reasons that he thought so. But I believe that when we get into Bible chronology, we should at least give a lot of thought to that. If you want to go with 23 or 22 or 25, that's something different. All right, now, anyway, that's what he says about the second section. Now, the third section, which I think is in your outline on point 7, and that's what we probably all have more interest in. And I'm not going to read everything he says here, but I'm going to read what I think is we must read. The third section of the discourse reveals the reappearance of the southern and northern horns of the goat upon the ancient territories and their reaction upon the, and I love this phrase, Muslimized Latino Greek little horn. So see, Brother Thomas, in one word, lets us know that the Muslims are going to be present. I'm sure that's in the outline. Should be under... Seven three. So notice it in the outline. We'll get there probably and say more about it. But he says it's in its Muslimized, I can't say that word, Latino Greek position. That's the exposition of Daniel, page 48. Okay. The pushing at this and the subjection of the southern horn by the northern horn, the invasion of the Holy Land by this horn, the destruction of this power by Michael, the great commander, the deliverance of Judah, the resurrection of some of the dead, and the reconcentration of the power of all the tribes of Israel in a time of trouble such as the world has never known. And notice Brother Thomas says, since the confusion of human speech. So he takes us back to the Tower of Babel. And that's Daniel 12:1, which we've talked about. And the only reason I would probably talk about it more is I think if we see what he's saying here, he's clearly associating Daniel 12:1 with that end time. Okay? Some of this has been covered, and I'm not going to cover what I think is it registered in my brain. So if it won't be that much, I'll try to minimize duplication. But anyway, I think we all are very conscious that Daniel had a tremendous understanding of the prophetic word. 17 years old, he was interpreting for the king. So he must have known what he was doing, and Yahweh was directing him. So it should be no question that he was a avid student to prophecy. He knew both Gabriel and Michael. How we want to feel about that. Were they present immediately with him, or did they speak to him through some other means? I don't know, and I don't know whether the scripture really reveals it to us. I like to think that at least he saw them, if in vision. After that, you can draw your own conclusions. I think, but it's already come out very strongly in our earlier classes that the angels were present, not just Gabriel and Michael, but all kinds of angels, myriads of angels were present, working with David. And we'll see that as we move into in all the periods. But even our day, you know, we think everything that's happening in the kingdom of men is being moved by these, by the angels. I think Brother Mansfield may make a statement, they are busy at work. And I think that's a good way to look at it. I also want to think for a moment that Daniel was a prophet, but he was also a statesman. Let's just drop over to 8:27. No, that's not my verse. Hang on a minute. 6:28 says, "So Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian." Also wanted that verse that says that he was made the president. Somebody may have to help me with that. I've got it written, but I can't don't see it. So that doesn't it. 6:2. Yeah, that's good. Let's read 6:2 and 3. And over these three, this is during the reign, this is the kingdom of Darius, three presidents, and of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might account unto them, and the king should have no damage. Then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. So, you know, it's easy for us to remember, you know, Daniel in the lion's den, but we also should remember that he sat in the number two spot, number two position in the kingdom of Darius. So he was, I think it's fair to call him a statesman. So he was a prophet and a statesman. You can draw what conclusions you like on that. He also was active with Nebuchadnezzar. And this goes back very early to Brother David's classes. But let's go back there for a moment and let's read verses 46 and, well, I'd like to read 46 to make another comment, and we'll also read 48. Notice in 46 it says, "Then the king Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshiped Daniel, and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors to him." Notice we have a name, Nebuchadnezzar. So we know the event. But then suddenly, it doesn't say Nebuchadnezzar anymore. It says the king answered unto Daniel and said, "Of a truth, it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of lords and a revealer of secrets, seeing that thou couldest reveal this secret." 48, "Then the king made Daniel a great man, and gave him many great gifts, and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon." I say that's a pretty high position. Now, see, we immediately refer to that to Nebuchadnezzar, and it appropriate speaks to Nebuchadnezzar. But what's the key to us when it doesn't say Nebuchadnezzar? It says the king. It's telling us that this has more to teach us. So we can see immediately Nebuchadnezzar becomes a type of latter-day kings that submit to the God of Israel. Anybody want to make any comments as we go through this, it's fine with me. I want to get us a feeling that Nebuchadnezzar, has a representation to us of the sheep nations in the age to come, and his acknowledgement of the God of Israel and his elevation of Daniel to a position of importance. You know, that shouldn't be too much of a jump for us to appreciate. With saying that, what we need to keep in mind that all events that we look at now in Daniel 11 are going to be foreshadowing. We get into all the detail between verses 5 and 29, and it's enormous. It can be, to the unenlightened, it can be very boring. It's not boring. It should be exciting. And the reason it should be exciting is we should immediately think that of the foreshadowing events. I would suggest to us that if we could really understand 5 through 29, we probably could put together many present-day events. And the reason is we're dealing in the same territory. Okay, I'm going to take a minute on maps. I put this one up because we had it up the other night, and I just want to, that'll bring a lot of things back to our minds. I always feel like I want a pointer, and I can point on here, right? But this, think of, and this puts particularly the younger people here, and maybe us older ones too, it kind of gives us a view of Western Asia. You know, we have the Balkans, we have the, that's not going to work for me, we have Constantinople, we have Asia Minor, we have Mesopotamia and Syria, Egypt, which is the Ptolemaic Empire, we have the Seleucid Empire, which is Persia, and we'll look at this in a clearer view a little bit later, and we have down in Saudi Arabia the Wahhabis, which are the very strong-minded people in that area, which we deal with as terrorists. Everybody has a pretty good feeling for that territory, we hope. Okay. Now, back to Babylon, where we just read in chapter 2. Keep in mind that Daniel 5, that's the Feast of Belshazzar. And if you look in Daniel 5, and let's read verses 22, 30, and 31. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. So that's really, you know, Belshazzar's being, I guess the word is, told pretty directly. And we see in verse 30, that night Belshazzar the king of the Chaldeans was slain, and Darius the Mede took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So, see, there's a clear distinction between Nebuchadnezzar's reaction and Belshazzar's reaction. Now, I want you to take that immediately into the future. And that helps us understand, let's look at 7:12. I know this has been alluded to and probably, but this is a point that we want to make sure we make. As concerning the rest of the, well, let's read 11 and 12. I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. I beheld even till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. We think of Belshazzar. Okay? Now, fourth beast, Babylon, the papal system, which we'll come to when much later, but right now, and in verse 12, as concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I think Brother Mac told us the other day, that's 1,000 years, so it's speaking of the millennium, and it's talking about the other nations. That's the nations other than the fourth beast nation. And it is typified in what we read in 2 under the caption, the king, you know, who submitted, as it were, to Daniel, praised Daniel, told his those he ruled over to submit to Daniel, do what Daniel said. So as we read through Nebuchadnezzar, you know, let's think about the rest of the beasts of Daniel 7. Also think of, when we read about Belshazzar, think about the fourth beast. And that comes out in Daniel 11. So this is foundational to understanding Daniel 11. If we don't understand the foundation of this, we're not going to necessarily pick up the other. Now I want to go back as we, want to do one other thing on another map. This is my favorite map, so most of you have seen it before, but I want you to, this takes us into much things here. This takes us into much later times, because it has kind of a mixture of Daniel 11 and our times and also previous times. But, one point we'll talk about, and we need to mention it now. The king of the north is eventually going to be Gog of the land of Magog, Russia. Okay? Now, we've had all kinds of hassles in our community about this. But here's an old Bible map. By the way, most new Bibles don't have this. Because why do you think they changed it? To make the Christians happy. Okay? And the Christians, one thing we all know about them is they don't really worry about accuracy. They're worried about happiness. Okay? So, the Mediterranean is called the Sea of Tarshish. We find Tarshish on the southern coast of Spain. We'd call that Gibraltar. We have Gomer. We have the descendants of Gomer. And you younger folks here probably know this map better than I do. But that essentially is France moving eastward into Germany. And we have Tubal and Meshech, Gomer, descendants of Magog. You can read the rest of them. But that's important to fix when we begin to look at the king of the north, because the king of the north is always going to be who holds this territory. Okay? The king of the south is going to be the one that holds this territory. And that will include what Brother Thomas called Eastern Tarshish, which is India. So, you know, that's a, get it in your minds, and we need to get it in the younger we are. So you young folks, see it today and you'll never get it out of your mind. Okay, we want to go back to the early verses just to cover the territory. This whole 11th of Daniel is a history of the world from the gathering of from the history of the world from Cyrus to the gathering of the divine family into the man of one. We have had some very interesting classes on the man of one. They're worthy of us thinking about. When we, from the time of Cyrus, to the gathering of the divine family, into the man of one, is the period that we cover. Well, I don't think we have, well, we shouldn't have, we can talk about the events, and we don't have any problem. The events would be perhaps as early as 540 and to the Advent. I don't know what I've skipped, so we'll kind of begin back to verse 1. It's a message from Gabriel in the first year of Darius. Brother Thomas says this was the first year of Cyrus because they reigned conjointly. He reigned conjointly with Cyrus for 2 years. So Cyrus' third year was therefore the first year as the sole ruler. And then verse 2 tells us that out of the Persian kingdom was to arise three kings to stand up after Cyrus. And Brother Thomas gives them as Ahasuerus, Smerdis, Darius, and that would be Darius Histapes. Then a fourth king, Xerxes, who will be far richer than they all. A side note was that Artaxerxes would reign in 456, and Ishiah's decree would start the 70 years. So, the time now moves, and verse 3 should become very, I don't think anybody questions verse 3. It's the times move to the Grecian period and speak of Alexander the Great. And if I have a, this is kind of to help us look at now, there's some overlapping of these this one is captioned in the history book I got out of the growth of the Persian Empire. And you probably can't see it, but the darker green is the Persian core territory. The lighter is the Empire of Cyrus, then Cambyses, and then the conquest by Darius. So when we look at all of it, that's pretty much the territory that Darius ruled over. Okay, up there we're at the Empire of Alexander the Great. And I guess we can get somewhat of a feeling for how much territory he conquered. He clearly moved far to the east. I think Darrell probably already said this. His empire went to the Indus River, so he's pretty close to India, probably at India. You know, I don't know about you, I'll just give you a clue that when I look at maps, the first thing I look at is for this horse looking like sea. That's the Caspian Sea, which takes us into Russia, the Aral Sea, and the Black Sea. If we can get those three seas in our mind, we kind of know what's happening to the how we move southward. Okay, with Alexander's empire. Verse 4 sets forth four prophecies that can solidify the claim that this is only applicable to Alexander. Fourfold divisions and this is from the verse, not to be left to his posterity, that means not left to his descendants, plucked up and broken into many pieces in 20 turbulent years. Ptolemy, Seleucus, Lamachus, Lysimachus, I guess we say, Cassander, two were eliminated because they sought unification of the empire with Antigonus, I think you pronounce it. There was four kingdoms by 301 B.C. And we have this is straight out of the history book, so we shouldn't have any problems with it. I kind of think this is a good slide because it shows us the divisions. This is in the north, and the south. So when we talk about the king of the north, we're talking about the empire of the Seleucus, and in the south, Ptolemy or Ptolemaic Egypt. This is in 303. This is in 301. And the last one, which you may not be able to see, is in 180 B.C. This was a very turbulent time. In fact, I think in your outline, there is a statement. I guess it's not in your outline. It's in my outline. But this was a very... a great time of upheaval. These people were fighting like you wouldn't believe. And I want you to keep that in mind when we get to class 3, because these same nations are active today, and if we see it correctly, they will become more and more active. Okay, so the king of the north and the king of the south will leave the national, the world scene for about 300 years. And then sometime in the 1800s, they reappear in a more organized form. Now the territories obviously never left, but they were under either the Greek or the Roman domination. And as Darrell pointed out the other day, I won't go back into it so much, but the focus shifted on changing them from a political entity to a more religious entity. And that's when we got the two legs of the East and Western Christian world, known to us even in Nebuchadnezzar's image by the East and Western legs. So it changed from political as it was this time, although that was, and Darrell made these points, and that we need to think about them, although the religious factors were not overriding, they were there, and the false beliefs transferred. So there was never a time in which, say, really, there was no religion. They were religious, just like they are today. You know, today when we think about the Islamic people, well, they're plenty religious. We think about the Western Christian worlds, which we would predominantly say they're Roman Catholic. I was reading, and I hope I get a chance to read some of this today, from Grattan Guinness in Light for the Last Days, and he's bragging, and this is in the mid-1800s, well, 1875 probably, 1887, he's bragging about the Protestants that have now 110 million people. And that is a formidable number. But compared to living in a Catholic society as the 1800s previously were, well, if we went back to 1400. But see, the religion of the Catholicism had dominated, and that's what we'll see in verses 36 to 39. So Grattan Guinness is very happy that and he really does a great book on Light for the Last Days, which I want to read a little bit of it, time permitting. So, anyway, this first section, I kind of wanted to maybe get about where we are. We now have the King of the North, and if you look on your outline, you see the first ruler was Seleucus I, surnamed or additionally named Nicator, and he reigned from 312 to 280. We have Ptolemy I, who was also known as Soter I. I think Darrell told us that Soter means savior. He reigned from 323 to 285. I don't know how much of that we're going to take time to go through, but to me that can be helpful to you and to me, is to, when we're reading through dates and we suddenly want to know who's reigning, if we say, well, a great one would be to take his 260. 260, we looked at the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. So it was done in Alexandria, Egypt, which would be, you know, right here. Alexandria, Egypt. And so that was kind of a religious center. It was done, who was ruling? Well, if you look on our list, we see it was Ptolemy II, known as Philadelphus. We also note, and we'll do that in the next period. I think it's important for us to know that all these men, I think this is maybe a little bit of a stretch, but we'll talk about it when we start next class. But it's probably a little bit of a stretch to say all these are in symbol presented in the scriptures. But I think they probably are. I counted through them, and I would say of the 25 maybe names there, 20 of them are written in Adam Clark's commentary. Brother Thomas's analysis has virtually all of them. Since I got 2 minutes before a break, maybe this is a good time to do it. And I'm still debating in my own mind, well, how much of this we want to read through. But Brother Thomas paraphrases the 11th of Daniel. And guess who was the, where this paraphrase probably came from? Probably came from a guy named Bishop Newton, who, by the way, Adam Clark gets it from Bishop Newton. And I have Adam Clark's, and in some ways I prefer to read Adam Clark's to Brother Thomas's, but always if Brother Thomas significantly differs, then I'm going to say Brother Thomas is right. But Mr. Elliott, well, he does a nice job on it, is he puts a lot more in than Brother Thomas writes in his paraphrase. But it's interesting, and it's, I tell you, this is worthy of our consideration. In here, it's from page 49 through, oh boy, through 53, I guess, in the exposition of Daniel. We're going to look at some of it. And as you trace those down, you'll see, you know, the names don't appear, but it'll say the King of the South, or it'll say the King of the North. Back as far as Newton, and probably earlier, but as far as Newton, those names were identifiable. It goes so far, well, look, I'll take one. Can I have 1 minute of the break? I'll give it back to you at the end. Huh? I'll take 1 minute of it if I can find my note. Seems to me it was on 626. That's not my note. That's the number I remember. I'm not good at remembering numbers. Well, we'll run across it in a minute. I'll tell you now what Mr. Clark says. Mr. Clark says, for profane history, the Bible is more accurate than all the historians. Hopefully I'll find that before the day is over, the morning is over. But he makes a point that particularly in this period of time, he says in the from the Persian Empire to the Grecian Empire and into this what is called the Diadochi kingdoms, that the time is more accurate as that we get from the scriptures than any of the historians. Sounds like something Brother Thomas would say. But for that, he says that when you're looking at the history of those eras, you're best to look at the scriptures. Okay, we'll take a break.